sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. As of this recording, the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth have reached 1,902 signatories on their petition demanding a new investigation into the events of 9/11. That number keeps growing, and quite rapidly lately. Their goal is to reach 2,000 signatories by the 12th anniversary in September. There are also 17,000 other supporters who have signed the petition. So you too, if you haven't already done so, can go to the website ae911truth.org and sign the petition, either as an architect or engineer, if you are one. I'm told they have a serious vetting process. Or you can sign up as a supporter. Things won't change if we don't do our part. Today, the focus of the show will be false flag operations and domestic terrorism. With so many people questioning the Boston Marathon bombings, and with the official version of events starting to crumble and being in direct conflict with eyewitness accounts and videos, it seemed like a good time to revisit these topics and to make a few connections to the Boston Marathon bombings. So we're going to start today with an audio clip by James Corbett of The Corbett Report, discussing false flag events. And this is a few years old. So here goes. Here's James Corbett.
Those who have studied history know that nothing invigorates and empowers an authoritarian regime more than a spectacular act of violence, some sudden and senseless loss of life that allows the autocrat to stand on the smoking rubble and identify himself as the hero. It's at moments like this that the public, still in shock from the horror of the tragedy that has just unfolded before them, can be led into the most ruthless despotism. Despotism that now bears the mantle of security. Acts of terror and violence never benefit the average man or woman. They only ever benefit those in positions of power. This is why Nero fiddled while Rome burned. It gave him a chance to throw out the Christians to the lions and rebuild the capital of the Roman Empire in his own image. This is why Hearst and the warmongers of the emerging American Empire were delighted by the destruction of the USS Maine in Havana Harbor in 1898. It gave them the excuse they needed to rouse the public into supporting the Spanish-American War. This is why Israel attacked the USS Liberty in 1967 during the Six-Day War, strafing and torpedoing it relentlessly for hours in a vain attempt to send it to the bottom. The Israelis believed that the loss of the Liberty could be blamed on Egypt and draw the Americans into war. This is why there are hundreds of documented examples of government staging attacks in order to blame them on their political enemies. In every civilization, in every culture, in every historical period, authoritarians have known that spectacular acts of violence help to further consolidate their own power and control. And sadly, throughout history, there have been all too many willing to allow attacks to occur, to pretend that attacks have occurred, or even to attack their own population in order to further their political agenda. To think that such staged provocations and false flag attacks no longer occur would be as unrealistic as believing that human nature itself has changed, that powerful people no longer seek to increase their power, that influence is never used for deceit or manipulation, that lies are no longer told to satisfy greed or slake the thirst for control. It is to believe that our society is immune from those things that we have seen in every other society, in every other era. In short, it's a dangerous delusion. The people are once again learning the power of this delusion. They are learning the extent to which they have been lied to. They are once again studying their history. The Russians are learning how the FSB was caught planting bombs in Moscow in 1999 during a terror scare that swept Putin into power and stirred the public into supporting the Second Chechen War. They are learning how their autocratic ex-president came to power campaigning on the graves of those his old FSB cronies had killed. The Israelis are learning how Mossad has been caught time and again posing as the very Muslim terrorists they claim to be opposing. They are learning how Israel uses the specter of terror to further extend their blank check drawn on American funds to expand their police state at home and maintain their hardline stance, the world's sixth largest nuclear superpower supposedly threatened by the possibility that one of their neighbors may one day obtain a single nuclear weapon. The British are learning how their SAS officers were caught dressing up as Arabs in Iraq, driving around with trucks full of munitions, shooting at police to stir up ethnic tensions and ensure that permanent bases could be built in the region. They're learning how Harun Aswat, the supposed mastermind behind the 7/7 bombings, was working for British intelligence. They're learning how British military intelligence took part in IRA bombings. The Indians are learning how the Mumbai attack was helped by a US agent who is cooperating with investigators so that he won't face questioning by foreign authorities. The Canadians are learning how their own provincial police dressed up as protesters in 2007 and threatened violence against other police in order to force a crackdown on peaceful protests. And the Americans. The Americans are learning that there were multiple bombs found, dismantled, and taken out of the Alfred P. Murrah building on April 19, 1995. They are learning that Timothy McVeigh had written a letter to his sister in which he claimed to be in the Special Forces for the U.S. Army. They are learning the bombing was being directed by FBI informants, just as the 1993 World Trade Center bombing was. They are learning about 9/11 and the Gulf of Tonkin and Operation Northwoods and their own Army counterinsurgency manuals that teach officers how to commit false flag attacks to blame on their enemies. In short, the people are learning the truth. And now we see the same build-up to a false flag event taking place that we saw in 1995. At that time, the US had a corporate media desperate to fling mud at anyone concerned by the actions of their government, and it had a government that was desperately unpopular. Today, we see the exact same factors at play. If anything, the situation today is worse than it was in the run-up to the Oklahoma City bombing, with media consolidation meaning that groups of concerned citizens like the Oath Keepers are being attacked by the controlled minions on both the left and the right. And now it is not just the militia that is being demonized by the establishment. It is veterans and gun owners, third-party supporters and libertarians, anti-war protesters, and human rights campaigners, people who are upset with a government giving trillions to the banks that have engineered our current financial crisis. In short, everyone is now a potential terrorist, according to the governmental and media agencies that deign to limit our range of acceptable opinion and control dissent. Even the word terrorist means something more than it did back in 1995, now after the false flag attack of 2001 allowed the passage of the Patriot Act, after the boogeyman of Al-Qaeda gave the NSA the opportunity to announce that they were collecting everyone's emails and everyone's telephone calls, after the former White House press secretary came out and admitted that the Bush administration had made up terror threats in order to scare the people into supporting the government, now we know what the real definition of terrorism is. It is governments scaring their own populations into line. But there is something else that's different now from what it was in 1995. The people are learning something else about terrorism. They are not terrorists for speaking out against their government. They are not terrorists for wanting the government to stop selling their children into servitude to pay bankers their bonuses. They are not terrorists for pointing out that the FBI and the CIA and Mossad and MI6 are behind every major international terrorist event. The people are not terrorists because they do not want to see more death. They do not want more destruction. The spilling of the blood of their fellow citizens is not in their interests. Death and destruction only ever serve the governmental and financial and industrial interests who always grow in power and wealth in the wake of every tragedy. Time and again, the people pay with their lives, and the governments and the banks and the war machine only grows and prospers. The people do not want terrorism because it does not benefit them. It only benefits the existing power structure. And this time, if there is another staged event to blame on the government's enemy of the day, the people will know who to blame. For the Corbett Report in Western Japan, I am James Corbett.
And here's a recent audio clip of James Corbett talking about domestic terrorism. And this comes from Global Research TV, from the website globalresearch.ca. And here he is, James Corbett.
The Boston Marathon bombing has provoked shock, grief, and outrage from around the world. After decades of conditioning, the public automatically equates such terrorism with Muslim radicals, but the evidence shows that every major terror plot on American soil in the past 10 years has been fostered, funded, and equipped by one organization, the FBI. This is the GRTV Backgrounder,
on Global Research TV.
People around the world watched in horror this week as explosions rocked the finish line of the Boston Marathon, turning a day of sportsmanship and celebration into one of shock, grief, and outrage. As with all such events, the desire to discover who was behind this cowardly act has driven many into a speculative frenzy. And, in a sad reminder of the indoctrination that the Western world has been under for over a decade now in the mythical War of Terror, it did not take long at all before the collective finger of the mob was pointed squarely in the direction of Muslim terrorists.
Within hours of the blast, fear spread throughout the international Muslim community that the bombing would be connected to an Islamist extremist. A Libyan Twitter user touched a nerve and received hundreds of retweets and worldwide media coverage by tweeting, "Please don't be a Muslim." The backlash began shortly thereafter, with the New York Post falsely implying that a Saudi national was being questioned for his possible role in the attack. The next day, a plane departing Boston Logan Airport returned to the gate, and two passengers were forcibly removed because they had been overheard speaking Arabic before takeoff.
As data continues to pour in regarding the bombing and who may be behind it, it is important that we take a moment to step back and consider this knee-jerk tendency to conclude that this is the work of Islamic radicals. In the minds of millions of Americans, bombs targeting innocents on U.S. soil are inextricably linked with the image of the bearded, turban-wearing boogeyman that has become the shorthand for evil in this age of terror. This association is not only incorrect, it is dangerously incorrect, because it signally fails to identify the one unifying thread between all of the recent terror plots in the U.S. Lurking behind the shadowy armies of would-be jihadis in the popular imagination is the sober reality that every single major terror bust in the United States since 9/11 has sourced back to the same group, a single entity that is in every single case funded, equipped, and even incited the would-be terrorists into action. The FBI.
In 2005, federal prosecutors charged Michael Reynolds, a 47-year-old drifter living with his elderly mother, of attempting to wage jihad on the U.S. by blowing up fuel facilities. He was arrested after agreeing to meet with an FBI informant who had promised him $40,000 for his cause, and 2 months later the FBI quietly announced he was likely mentally ill. In 2007, the so-called Fort Dix Six were nabbed in a much-hyped FBI terror bust after allegedly hatching a plan to attack a U.S. military base and kill the soldiers there. At the time, a 26-page indictment revealed that the group had no rigorous military training and did not appear close to being able to pull off an attack. The next year, it was revealed that the FBI informant who had infiltrated the group had in fact offered to organize the members and lead the plot itself. In 2009, the Newburgh Four were arrested for an alleged plot to blow up synagogues and shoot down military airplanes in Newburgh, New York. The group was a ragtag bunch of poor black men, at least one of whom was mentally unstable and stored his own urine in jars around his apartment. The group's fifth member, Shahad Hussein, turned out to be an FBI informant who had promised the members hundreds of thousands of dollars to carry out the plot. In sentencing the defendants, federal judge Colleen McMahon said, "The government created acts of terrorism out of the defendants' fantasies of bravado and bigotry, and then made those fantasies come true. The government did not have to infiltrate and foil some nefarious plot. There was no nefarious plot to foil." In November 2010, the FBI busted the so-called Portland Christmas tree bomber, who was allegedly attempting to bomb the lighting ceremony at Portland's Pioneer Courthouse Square. "The threat was very real," the FBI intoned at the time. "Our investigation shows that Mohammed was absolutely committed to carrying out an attack on a very grand scale." The alleged bomber, Arthur Balazan, turned out to be a teenager who bragged to undercover agents that he could get a gun because he was a rapper and wrote an article on workout tips for jihadis. In 2011, the FBI arrested a man that they themselves had supplied with a remote-controlled plane and C4 explosives in a harebrained attempt to bomb the Pentagon. In 2012, they busted another would-be jihadi that they again had supplied with a fake gun and suicide vest. Also in 2012, the FBI busted a group of five anarchists who were allegedly going to bomb a bridge in the Cleveland area, although it was quietly admitted that the FBI informant who had infiltrated the group had in fact initiated the contact with them and been present at the meetings where they developed the plan to blow up the bridge. One of the most ridiculous examples of this pattern dates back to 2006, when the DOJ attempted to make it seem as if they had just nabbed a group of dangerous jihadis who were preparing a full ground war against the United States.
This is former Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, and he's followed by John Stewart.
Now, fortunately, because of the fine work of law enforcement, these men were unable to advance their deadly plot.
A dreadful potential catastrophe averted. And clearly, government wouldn't bother to hold a press conference if this were not a major step in the war on terror, right? All right, so good night, everybody. And, questions.
Did the man have any actual contact with any members of Al-Qaeda that you know of?
The answer to that is no.
Did you find any explosives, weapons?
And you raise a good point.
You do raise a good point. That point being that these deadly international terrorists had very slyly disguised themselves as a bunch of dipshits living in a warehouse.
The picture that is painted by these facts is as overwhelming as it is difficult for much of the public to comprehend. The conclusion, nevertheless, is incontrovertible, that without the FBI, many of the so-called terrorist cells that have been hatching their inept, bumbling schemes against the United States for decades might never have existed at all. Despite what many would believe, this conclusion is not even controversial. Rather, it has been backed up time and again by evidence in the official record and multiply attested to by FBI insiders and whistleblowers themselves.
And here's former CBS News reporter Dan Rather.
Last winter, the FBI was praised for its speed in cracking the case of the World Trade Center bombing and bringing four suspects to trial. Now, there is some evidence that the FBI may have known of the plot in advance through an informant and might even have stopped the bombing that killed six people. Correspondent Jacqueline Adams has the story.
FBI agents might have been able to prevent last February's deadly explosion at New York's World Trade Center. They discussed secretly substituting harmless powder for the explosives, but they didn't, according to the FBI's own informant, Imad Salem.
Knowing what I know, and again, this was written 91 days before the attack, knowing what I know, I can confidently say that until the investigative responsibilities for terrorism are removed from the FBI, I will not feel safe. The FBI has proven for the past decade it cannot identify and prevent acts of terrorism against the United States and its citizens at home and abroad. Even worse, there is virtually no effort on the part of the FBI's International Terrorism Unit to neutralize known and suspected terrorists residing within the United States. Unfortunately, more terrorist attacks against American interests coupled with the loss of American lives will have to occur before those in power give this matter the urgent attention it deserves. Realizing more American lives are going to be needlessly lost, no one should expect me to consciously sit idly by and pretend to forget the things I know. By sharing what I know, the terrorism problems plaguing America may be corrected. Knowing what I know, I truly believe I would be derelict in my duty as an American if I did not do my best to bring the FBI's dereliction of duty to the attention of others.
Given all of this damning history and insider whistleblowing, it is vital that the Western public break out of their media-induced programming and question the core assumptions of the war on terror paradigm that we have been programmed with for decades now. If there is to be speculation at all over events like these, and if there is any group that has to present a thoroughgoing case for why it is not responsible for this atrocity, surely it is the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Having been at the heart of so many terror plots in the past, both the hilariously inept and the chillingly successful, how could the public refuse to even interrogate the organization that has the most to answer for? The simple fact of the matter is that the history of the modern age of terrorism has proven time and again that the FBI is the prime suspect in any terrorist atrocity that takes place on American soil. Let us all keep this in mind as the details of the investigations into this and all other American terrorist incidents begin to emerge.
And now here's Ben Swan on the Fox News show Reality Check. And he's introduced by another Fox News reporter.
We're learning more tonight about the Boston Marathon bombing, and yet there are still so many questions that have not been answered. The biggest one, of course, is who's behind it? Ben is looking back at some recent history in order to look forward in a reality check you won't see anywhere else.
In what has become the first terror bombing or explosion in the U.S. since 9/11, the biggest question tonight is who is responsible? Tonight, we know more about what happened. The explosives used in this deadly Boston Marathon bombing were contained in 1.6-gallon pressure cookers hidden in black duffel bags on the ground. A person briefed on the investigation told that to the Associated Press. Now, one of the explosives contained shards of metal and ball bearings. Another contained nails. Those two bombs blew up about 10 seconds apart Monday, tearing off victims' limbs and leaving the streets spattered with blood and strewn with broken glass. Three people were killed, including an 8-year-old boy. More than 170 people were wounded. So the big question that has not been answered yet is, who is behind these attacks? So far, the FBI has questioned a Saudi national and has searched his apartment but found no signs of evidence against him. No groups have come forward claiming responsibility. And tonight, intelligence officials say they do not believe this was an Al-Qaeda plot. So who was behind it? Well, no one knows at this point, or at least no one is saying. The last time the U.S. saw a bombing attempt like this was 1993. It was during the World Trade Center bombing. That explosion left 6 people dead, more than 1,000 injured. Damages in excess of $500 million. But there is a part of the World Trade Center bombings that is severely underreported. That it was the FBI presiding over the terrorists who carried out the 1993 bombing. In fact, virtually no one would know that fact today had it not been for this man, Imad A. Salim, a 43-year-old former Egyptian army officer. He was used by our government to penetrate a circle of Muslim extremists. According to extensive reporting by the New York Times, Mr. Salim secretly recorded hundreds of hours of conversations with the feds. Again, according to the Times, law enforcement officials were told the terrorists were building a bomb that was eventually used to blow up the World Trade Center. They planned to thwart the plotters by secretly substituting harmless powder for the explosives. The informer was to have helped the plotters build the bomb and supply the fake powder, but the plan was called off by an FBI supervisor. The account portrays the authorities as in a far better position than previously known to foil the February 26 bombing of New York City's tallest towers. Well, what this means for you, again tonight, we know very little about what happened. But we do know this. The University of Mobile's cross-country coach told a local TV affiliate that he was near the finish line of the Boston Marathon when the explosions went off. He said he thought it was odd that there were bomb-sniffing dogs at both the start and the finish lines. He also said that law enforcement spotters were on the roofs at the start and end of the race. So the question tonight must be asked, did the FBI have any knowledge of this plot before it happened? We do know for a fact that dozens of times since 9/11, the FBI has recruited, trained, and then taken down suspected terrorists before they could carry out their plots. That's not conspiracy, that's a fact. Is the practice of the FBI creating terror plots only to break them up before they can actually happen really making us safer? Is that what happened here? And that is Reality Check.
You can find the sources for this story on our website, fox19.com. And if you'd like to make your voice heard, head over to Ben's Facebook page. You can find him by searching Ben Swan.
And here's some really important news that you may have missed. It didn't get much media attention because it came out at around the same time that the Boston bombing happened. Coincidence? You decide.
We turn now to a landmark nonpartisan review of interrogation and detention methods used in the post-9/11 era that concludes the United States engaged in torture. The 577-page report was 2 years in the making and found the highest officials in the George W. Bush administration were responsible. It was conducted by the Task Force on Detainee Treatment, an 11-member panel convened by the Constitution Project after President Obama chose not to support a national commission to investigate the counterterrorism programs. The authors of the report wrote that never before in U.S. history had there been, quote, the kind of considered and detailed discussions that occurred after 9/11 directly involving a president and his top advisors on the wisdom, propriety, and legality of inflicting pain and torment on some detainees in our custody. The bipartisan panel was co-chaired by Asa Hutchinson, a former GOP congressman from Arkansas, NRA consultant, and undersecretary of the Department of Homeland Security under President George W. Bush.
We found that U.S. personnel in many instances used interrogation techniques on detainees that constitute torture. American personnel conducted an even larger number of interrogations that involved cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment. Both categories of actions violate U.S. laws and international treaty obligations. This conclusion is not based upon our own personal impressions, but rather is grounded in a thorough and detailed examination of what constitutes torture from a historical and legal context. We looked at court cases and determined that the treatment of detainees in many instances met the standards the courts have determined as constituting torture. But in addition, you look at the United States State Department in its annual country reports on human rights practices has characterized many of the techniques used against detainees in U.S. custody in the post-9/11 environment. The State Department has characterized the same treatment as torture, abuse, or cruel treatment when those techniques were employed by foreign governments. The CIA recognized this in an internal review and acknowledged that many of the interrogation techniques it employed were inconsistent with the public policy positions the United States has taken regarding human rights. The United States is understandably subject to criticism when it criticizes another nation for engaging in torture and then justifies the same conduct under national security arguments. There are those that defend the techniques of like waterboarding, stress positions, and sleep deprivation because there was the Office of Legal Counsel which issued a decision approving of their use because they defined them as not being torture. Those opinions have since been repudiated by legal experts and the OLC itself. And even in its opinion, it relied not only on a very narrow legal definition of torture, but also on factual representations about how the techniques would be implemented that later proved inaccurate. This is an important context as to how the opinion came about, but also as to how policymakers relied upon it. Based upon a thorough review of the available public record, we determined that in application, torture was used against detainees in many instances and across a wide range of theaters. And while our report is critical of the approval of interrogation techniques that ultimately led to U.S. personnel engaging in torture of detainees, the investigation was not an undertaking of partisan fault-finding. Our conclusions about responsibility should be taken very simply as an effort to understand what happened at many levels of the U.S. policymaking. There is no way of knowing how the government would have responded if a Democrat administration were in power at the time of the attacks. Indeed, our report is equally critical of the rendition to torture program, which began under President Clinton, and we question several actions of the current administration as well. It should be noted that many of the corrective actions that were first undertaken during the Bush administration as well. But the task force did conclude that the nation's highest officials after the 9/11 attack approved actions for CIA and defense personnel based upon legal guidance that has since been repudiated. The most important decision may have been to declare the Geneva Convention did not apply to Al-Qaeda and Taliban captives in Afghanistan or Guantanamo. The administration never specified what rules would apply instead. The task force believes that U.S. defense intelligence professionals and service members in harm's way need absolutely clear orders on the treatment of detainees, requiring at a minimum compliance with common Article 3 of the Geneva Convention. This was not done. Civilian leaders and military commanders have an affirmative responsibility to ensure that their subordinates comply with the laws of war. President Obama has committed to observe the Geneva Conventions through an executive order, but a future president could change it by the stroke of a pen.
For more, we go to Washington, D.C., to Laura Petter, counterterrorism advisor at Human Rights Watch. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Laura. Can you talk about the significance of this report? And the man who's delivering the findings, Asa Hutchinson, was just in the news as an NRA consultant pushing armed guards in the schools. He is President Bush's administration official, the Undersecretary of Homeland Security.
Yeah, the report is very significant for the fact that this was a bipartisan commission that included individuals both on the Republican and the Democratic side with high levels of extensive national security experience. And they intended to look at the record objectively without any preconceived notions. And they ultimately came to the conclusion that the U.S. engaged in torture, and they found that the evidence was indisputable. And they found this without reservation. So it's very significant because, as you know, many of the former Bush administration officials who were in charge of authorizing the abuse and other senior-level intelligence officials who were involved in implementing the abuse have denied that what the U.S. did in its name to hundreds of detainees in U.S. custody was torture. So really, this commission should put those denials to rest. It clearly was torture, and this commission found so.
This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.